I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the story of a star reporter's fall. Kurt Eichenwald said he was trying to save a young man from pornography. His critics say, instead, he destroyed his own career. But first, we want to check in on Bangladesh, where aid workers are bracing for a second wave of death. Thousands were killed in last Thursday's Category 4 cyclone, which created a 16-foot tidal surge that ravaged coastal towns. As the water recedes, the losses are less than anticipated, but the difficulty today is in getting water, food and shelter to survivors in isolated areas, especially along the Bay of Bengal. Robert Patton is the regional director for the aid agency ADRA. He joins us now on a cell phone from Dhaka, the Bangladeshi capital. And Robert, what are some of the challenges rescue workers are facing?
The biggest one up until now has been access to the areas because of downed trees, damage to roads, infrastructure, etc. And communication's been a big problem as well.
What are the issues regarding food?
It's just that there is no food or very limited amount of food. Any crops that were there have been swept away or destroyed. Food that they may have had stored in their house is gone as well. For instance, the villages where ADRA is currently working, 100% of the houses are totally destroyed.
We understand that the rice crop was also about to be harvested.
That's correct, and it's being totally lost.
Well, government officials are saying that the losses are far less than anticipated, and we know that in 1991, when 140,000 people were lost in a storm, 1970, 500,000 people were lost in a storm. So there is a sense that an early detection system that was recently installed worked. What is your sense of that?
Definitely. There has been a reduction in the loss of lives through an event like this because of the early warning system, the evacuation of people to safe havens. But the actual damage to the livestock, to the livelihoods, to the homes of people is significant.
How about the government's working with NGOs? We understand in the past this military-backed government in Bangladesh did not work as well with NGOs such as yours, non-governmental organizations. How about this time around?
Well, the reports I'm getting from my local staff in the field is that they're working well with the government. The government have had teams out clearing roads. There has also been the government-funded helicopters moving in, doing some emergency distribution of food. I've heard positive comments on the role of the government and their response.
We're also hearing, though, that officials from the government are saying that they're finding clear roads, for instance. How does that square with your sense?
It's not what I'm hearing from my teams, and it's not what the photographs are showing that I'm getting back in the office. It's showing multiple trees down across roads, and these are large trees that require to be sawn and if you have machinery in to drag them off the road.
And shelter's another issue, but we understand that, as opposed to a decade ago, there were places for people to shelter, far more than there have been in the past.
Yes, there were places this time for people to shelter that have been built, you know, since the last events, but my understanding is that it was not enough and that there were still people that were exposed to the elements.
Well, this is a country of 150 million people. Has there been any conversation about people being moved from this area that's so vulnerable to weather?
The question is, where do you move them to? Because it is a very densely populated country, and you've got the problem at this time of year with the cyclonic storms on the coast and the storm surges that you get. But then if you move them further inland, you're going to get flooding during the monsoon. That's going to have an impact there. Effectively, you know, it's a floodplain, the whole of most of Bangladesh, and you know, if we take the floods earlier this year, 60% of the country was underwater. You know, when you look at that as, you know, a disaster that could happen every year with flooding, where do you move people to?
Reuters is quoting an aid worker as saying that, you know, they're bracing for this second wave of death. Do you think that's too strong a comment?
I don't believe so if there's not quick intervention now to prevent outbreaks of disease. I'm presuming that's what is meant by the second wave of death.
Robert Patton, regional director for the aid agency ADRA, speaking to us from Dhaka, the Bangladesh capital. Robert, thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Our conversation today may not be for everyone. It's about allegations of child pornography. It's a conversation about journalist Kurt Eigenwald. He's been a guest on this program, but today he's the story. Eigenwald earned his reputation as a New York Times business reporter, breaking the story of the Enron fiasco. But it was his sensational reporting on child pornography on the Internet that landed him on Oprah and before Congress, where he testified. But in claiming to shed light on that dark place, he shifted a spotlight to his own behavior and mistakes he admits he made playing both rescuer and reporter. By all accounts, his career is in tatters. David France, contributing editor at New York Magazine, writes about Kurt Eigenwald in a recent issue. He joins us now. And David, to remind listeners, 2 years ago, Eigenwald wrote a sensational front-page story about a young man named Justin Berry. Eigenwald says he found Justin's website while searching for a new subject to write about after Enron. Eigenwald reported that Berry operated his own illegal child pornography business from his bedroom using his computer and his webcam, selling images to a group of subscribers. You and others quickly ascertained that Justin Berry was not a child when Eigenwald met him, and while there is a web of child pornography on the Internet, this young man did not represent it. So take us through. Who was Justin Berry when Kurt found him in 2005? What was he doing?
At that point, he was a young man, almost 19 years old, with some reputation for having run an Internet pornography business based on his own starring role. He was out of the business, though, for the most part. He had found God. He had redirected his website to an evangelical Christian site called yayjesus.com. The website that Kurt Eigenwald found, in order to find evidence of what had been there, he had to go to a place on the web that archives old websites. And it was clear that this was an operation that was out of business. And it was clear from all the disclaimers that at least for 18 months or more, actually it was more like 22 months, Justin Berry was of legal age. He was meeting with an old associate of his, and they were contemplating the idea of relaunching a twink website, that is a website aimed at gay men that features models ages 18 to 24. But it was in the early stages of discussion at that point when Kurt Eigenwald came upon them.
At this point in the story, Kurt and his wife have told you they made a tactical decision. They were going to rescue Justin.
They made a very interesting conclusion based on their view of the old website that had been abandoned. They decided that it must be involved in child pornography. Although there was no evidence that it was, there was a little help icon, and it featured a photograph of Justin Berry when he was about 14 years old. And both Kurt and his wife found that picture so disturbing that they drew a conclusion that this must be a website involving child pornography. And they, whether motivated by some religious or moral or parental impetus, they decided they had to go and find this child and save this child from the Internet. And they did it not just with the two of them, but they brought in Kurt's own spiritual advisor, an Episcopal priest from Dallas, and the three of them cooked up this plan that they would go and find this kid.
So to be clear, by the time Kurt Eigenwald actually meets Justin Berry, he's legal age, but could it be said that Kurt Eigenwald assumed that, Justin had been doing, the kind of work he was doing for several years and so had been participating in this as a minor and so was still representative of, the seedy world of child pornography?
Certainly, you can't deny that he drew that conclusion. And he says that he did draw that conclusion, but he says it more forcefully. He says, no one could look at that archived website and not draw the conclusion that this was child pornography, that this was kiddie porn, that it was the tip of some iceberg of some vast kiddie porn operation in the Internet. That no one could come up with any other conclusion is the stretch that he made. And that's the fuel that he believed was going to motivate him and that he's claimed motivated him through the rest of his investigation.
When, in fact, we find out is that it was a kid pretty much by himself for the most part, alone in his bedroom working on his computer.
Well, and then Eigenwald sets up a meeting with him, and the kid flies up from Mexico. Eigenwald flies out from Dallas to Los Angeles. They meet at LAX. It's clear that the kid's 18, almost 19 years old, and still, at that moment, he could have called off the entire thing. At that moment, it's undeniable that this is an adult. And yet, he says that he keeps going with this rescue mission because he believes that even though he's almost 19 years old, he can't be consenting to his involvement in this website. And that's a moralistic perspective. It's not a legal perspective. Moralistically, he's saying that you can't, even at that age, if you're also doing drugs, if you have all these other things together, you are still a victim and you are still someone to be rescued.
Well, and in fact, there might be something to that, you know, seeing a lifestyle that a young person was leading. And in fact, Justin Berry thanks Kurt Eichenwald for getting him off that path, but it certainly wasn't the huge, vast network of young children that readers were led
to
believe.
And if he had been clear about that in his article, if he had said, I went and rescued an adult from the pornography industry, it would have been a different article,
right.
And people might have enjoyed reading it just the same. But he wrapped this one instead in child pornography, which ramped up its kind of moral urgency, and then testified before Congress about the need to go and prosecute all these people who were also involved in it. So the story became better by amplifying some of the aspects of it that may not have been fully founded in fact.
Kurt Eichenwald and his wife and his spiritual advisor, as they decided to rescue what they thought was this young man, Justin Berry, they got pulled into a pretty seedy rabbit hole. They did find, for instance, that Justin Berry was, as you said, thinking of starting up an association with an older man, and that there was a 14-year-old boy who might be involved in that.
That's true, but that comes after the involvement of the mm-hmm. Eichenwalds. What we have learned now, way post-publication, and you pointed out that Eichenwald's articles were published in 2005. Just earlier this year, we've discovered through some other lawsuits and criminal cases that there's evidence that Kurt Eichenwald was in discussions before the involvement of the 14-year-old, and in fact that he was posing as a potential business partner, or so it seemed, for this new website that they were going to launch, and passing a considerable amount of money over to Justin Berry and his partner. After the article published in 2005, several people were arrested, and those were kind of ancillary associates of Justin Berry and his partner. Four people have been sent to prison. One of those people who was sent to prison, he's now looking at 220 years in prison, so he's been doing a lot of real digging to try to figure out what may have gone on. Now, he was able to determine and prove that Eichenwald was involved financially pre-launch of this website.
Hold up there, because you raised two points. So Kurt Eichenwald was making payments to Justin Berry before Kurt revealed that he was a reporter. Eichenwald says it was to win the young man over. Eichenwald's wife says it was to lure Justin Berry from this new enterprise, this new legal website for young men. And this becomes a problem later, because when Eichenwald goes from rescuer to reporter, he doesn't tell his editors at the New York Times about these payments, which at face value look like investments in a porn website. But also, soon after making those payments, Eichenwald and everyone else realized that the second young man was just 14. They originally thought he was older. So now Kurt Eichenwald is stuck. If he reports the real minor here, the 14-year-old, he gets Justin Berry in trouble, because Justin Berry is creating this website. Oh, you know, what a web we weave. David France is contributing editor at New York Magazine. We're going to take a break. When we come back, another secret that Kurt Eichenwald kept from his editors. Also later today, just a reminder, there's been possibly explosive news in stem cell research. It could mean the use of embryos might be obsolete. It could. We'll take a look at that. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from David France, contributing editor at New York Magazine, who's written extensively about journalist Kurt Eichenwald. Eichenwald wrote that blockbuster story 2 years ago in the New York Times about a web of online child pornography. That story resulted in a handful of prosecutions, including a case in Tennessee that brought to light some of the problems with Eichenwald's own behavior reporting the story. First and foremost, that he made PayPal payments to the teenager who became the main source for his story. Eichenwald and his wife have said they were trying to rescue the teenager, Justin Berry, from the pornography business, even though he was an adult when they found him. So we've caught up. But recently, there's a new twist to this story. Kurt Eichenwald has a medical problem called grand mal epilepsy. His doctors say that may have caused him to forget some of the things he did while trying to rescue Justin Berry. So, David France, please pick up the story from there.
When he was confronted by his editors at the Times, they said, why didn't you tell us about the money? He said he just didn't remember. And at first, he was being confronted with a single check, a $2,000 check. And he talked about his memory issue in that regard. They asked him at that point, was there anything else that you haven't told us? Is there any more money? Is there anything else? Any other lapses? And he said no. And it took this convict from Tennessee to then show that there were, in fact, a dozen or more such transactions, and that those transactions add up to $2,000 or $3,000 more dollars, that, in fact, the end result may be over $4,000 that he paid. In a short couple-week period, he has not allowed me to talk to his neurologist or a psychologist, but both of them, according to him, filled out a declaration that his description of his memory problems does dovetail with their understanding of it. Now, I haven't found any neurologist or neurology or epilepsy expert who can tell me of another such case. So I don't know. I don't know that I can say that I credit it. His wife certainly credits it. She described a moment where the PayPal payments were first brought up in her presence to him, and she looked at him, and he had a look of total denial on his face. And she said, well, of course you did that. I was there. I knew that you did that. And she said at the time that his disbelief was characteristic with other things that he had forgotten in their long marriage.
You describe Kurt Eichenwald now as bunkered in his home in Dallas. He can't work. He thinks people are out to destroy him.
He's in a very paranoid state in his life, and he describes it that way. He knows that he is in a psychological tailspin. He describes it as being the result of this being pursued, being hunted. He feels hunted by pedophiles and their allies in the media. He believes that, for example, that he is stalked. He described to me that he believed that somebody was trying to cut through the gate in his backyard, the one around his pool in the backyard. And he sees the fingerprints of pedophiles in many things. And in a way, I do believe that he got too close to his story in that way, that it has disturbed him, this knowledge that he's gleaned, true or false, about the existence of, vast networks of pedophiles in the world. He's very concerned about them in a genuine way. But I also think that one of the things that is driving him to distraction now is his knowledge that people are hounding him in a way that's going to destroy his career, that people are looking at the shortcuts he took and the errors, which he admits that he made in the reporting of his story and in the promotion of it afterwards. He doesn't consider those errors fatal. He'd already left the Times and had moved over to work for Portfolio, the new business magazine at Condé Nast, and then tendered his resignation there as this was brewing around him. And so right now he's not associated with a news gathering organization for the first time in his 20-year career. And I would imagine it would be a while before he was able to prove that he was capable, much less trustworthy enough to be able to take that on again. And by capable, I mean he has now explained his actions by saying that epilepsy keeps him from remembering things that he does, keeps him from recalling aspects of stories that would be essential and germane to the reporting of that story. He has said that he's an unreliable narrator of events, and I think that alone would preclude or at least caution people against hiring him for a significant journalistic job.
Do you think this is sad?
I think it's very sad. I certainly feel tremendous sadness for Kurt Eichenwald, a man whose career was exceptional and one that he really created from his own hard work. He began at the New York Times as a copy boy, and very few people, especially in the modern age, have been able to rise from that to become a reporter, much less an investigative reporter of national significance as he did. And he did all of this while struggling with his own epilepsy, which, memory issues aside, had been a tremendous hindrance to him in his life and in his career. He started at the New York Times as a copy boy because he couldn't start in a local newspaper around the country, which is the way most of us began our careers, because he couldn't drive. He had to be in a major subway market. And New York was the one that he identified and the one that he kind of fought his way up. So he's tenacious. He's self-created. He's very clever in his reporting. And he's a terrific marketer for his work once he's finished it. And I think that when he got to the Justin Barry story, the whole thing somehow twisted his mind and made him see things that weren't necessarily there, made him read things in and read things out of the story as he saw it unfolding, and made tremendous and, I believe, career-fatal errors that really may have foreshortened a career that didn't deserve to be.
You know,
but I also feel sorry for all the people for the three or four people who are in jail, especially the one in Tennessee who I believe his involvement in this is so tangential. Does he deserve conviction? You know, I leave that up to somebody else to decide. But I feel confident to say that he doesn't deserve a 220-year sentence at a time when, you know, average manslaughter sentences are, you know, 7 to 15 range. So I think there's kind of pity to be felt all around. And I especially feel sorry for Justin Barry, who's, you know, one day I think will have a reckoning about all of this and wonder to himself why he did what he did and is there a way to kind of undo it.
David France, a contributing editor to New York Magazine. He wrote about Kurt Eichenwald in a recent issue, and you can read that article at our website, here-now.org. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Roman.
Okay, tomorrow, lead dangers for kids, including your car keys. Still ahead, rehabbing Plymouth Rock, here and now. Two scientific journals are publishing research today that, in the words of one medical ethicist, redefines the ethical terrain of stem cell research. The news today is of direct reprogramming. With it, ordinary skin cells are manipulated into producing new cells that researchers say are as versatile as stem cells, including the stem cells extracted from human embryos. Embryonic stem cells are controversial because while in theory they can grow into any kind of tissue and possibly someday treat diseases, to extract them destroys the embryo. Today's news brings hope to researchers that ordinary skin cells may soon replace stem cells. Scientists in Japan and the University of Wisconsin at Madison wrote today's reports. To learn more about them, we turn to Dr. Robert Lanza. He's chief science officer of Advanced Cell Technology in Massachusetts, a company that also conducts stem cell research. And Dr. Lanza, you're not holding back on your opinion of this news. You think it's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. This is a tremendous scientific breakthrough. It really is the holy grail of stem cell biology to be able to take a few cells from a patient, say a cheek swab or a few skin cells, and then turn them into stem cells directly in the laboratory.
You say this is the biological equivalent of the Wright brothers' first airplane.
Yes. This is really huge to be able to now just take a patient's own cell and to create these pluripotent cells.
Well, let's tell ourselves how this works.
Okay.
The skin cells we know were genetically manipulated. Take us through that process.
Yeah, so what they actually did is they took some skin cells and then they using viruses, which of course is a concern, they were able to upregulate certain transcriptional factors, certain molecules in the cell that allowed that cell to be reprogrammed, basically taken back in time so that it's essentially a cell that can now generate all of the cell types in the body.
So this virus is sort of the carrier, the Trojan horse that brought this material in?
Yes, it is. They had to genetically modify the cells. And, of course, the FDA would never allow us to use these virally modified cells in patients. And so they were successful in generating these embryonic stem cell-like colonies. But, again, we still need to figure out how to overcome the hurdle of using viruses.
Well, that would seem to be one big hurdle. And we understand another is that in doing this, it disrupts the DNA of the cell, which makes the cell vulnerable to cancer.
This is correct. In particular, one of the papers used an oncogene, something called c-MYC, and this is very strongly correlated with cancer.
Well, but still it holds hope for you because what?
Well, this is proof of principle. As you know, up until today, the generation of embryonic stem cells has required either human eggs or the destruction of embryos. So this bypasses, assuming we can achieve the end objective, all of the controversy associated with the field.
Well, which include the fact that embryos have to be destroyed to extract the stem cells, and even though some of these embryos are frozen in fertility clinics and people don't want them anymore, there are people who think that's life that's destroyed. But also, last week we were covering the story of the first cloned monkey embryo, and the embryos, the researchers were saying, would be used to extract stem cells. However, people are worried that cloning embryos to extract stem cells gets us one step closer to actually cloning humans. Does this take us off that path?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. In fact, it turns out you can use the cells that they've generated here, embryonic stem cells, to actually create clones. We routinely, for instance, will take embryonic stem cells, but mouse embryonic stem cells, and you can aggregate them with a pre-existing embryo, and you can actually generate an entire organism using those cells. So this might actually make it easier. I think that the upregulation of these certain factors in the cell might interfere with development. But once we perfect that, actually, you could use these cells to generate a clone.
So that controversy might still be on the table. And yet, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is calling this new research published today a very significant breakthrough in finding morally unproblematic alternatives to cloning, perhaps because they think that embryos are the only way to a clone.
Well, again, I think this is a strategy that there's a consensus on that doesn't involve very many ethical issues. But the very important thing here to remember is that we really need to temper the excitement with caution. This isn't over by a long shot. We've been fooled many, many times in the past, and breakthroughs that seem to be just around the corner often remain just around the corner for years and if not decades. And so we're hoping perhaps in the coming months to perfect the cloning technique, the therapeutic cloning approach, and that way we'd be allowed to or able to transplant cells into the patient without rejection. But to be truthful, we simply don't know how long any of these techniques are going to take to be perfected, whether or not it's cellular reprogramming or cloning. But remember, a delay of 10 years means we'd be writing off half of a generation.
And you're talking about people with Parkinson's and diabetes and other illnesses that you hope to cure. Remind us of that, because you mentioned the word rejection. Remind us why stem cells are so valuable for perhaps generating tissue that can be put into a body to replace damaged tissue.
Yeah, well, so say, for instance, you had diabetes. We could use embryonic stem cells to create new insulin-producing cells to treat diabetes. We may be able to produce new heart cells to transplant into the patients who may have had a heart attack. But the problem, unfortunately, is you can't just plunk those cells back into the body because your body will reject them. Now, right now, if you get a transplanted kidney or a heart, you need very powerful drugs that are associated with cancer and malignancy. So we need to really figure out how to transplant those cells without rejection. Now, of course, if you use cloning, they're the patient's own cells, and they can be transplanted without any problem. And also, we could use that technique to create a bank of cells that could match most of the U.S. population. So again, these are strategies that will allow us to get into the clinic with some of the technologies that we have developed.
Will this new direct reprogramming using skin cells instead of embryonic cells, is that going to make you reconsider your research? Ian Wilmot, who's the Scottish researcher who cloned Dolly the sheep 10 years ago, he's saying he is giving up cloning to focus on this new approach.
Well, I cannot overstate the need to continue all areas of stem cell research. There's a very real human tragedy out there, and we can't afford to drop other strategies on the hope that this might work in the coming years. Certainly, we are also pursuing this cellular reprogramming strategy. We're hoping to do it without the need for these viruses. But on the other hand, we really need to aggressively pursue the other approaches because, again, we don't know which of these approaches are going to work, but we've been fooled many times in the past, and we really need to pursue all of the approaches very aggressively. And until we have the answers, we really cannot afford to abandon the other approaches. One thing that we simply don't know with these new cells is are they exactly the same as normal embryonic stem cells? My guess is that we'll find that there are significant differences. In fact, in the paper, they mention when they look at the gene expression profile that there are indeed differences. So perhaps these may make neurons, but not insulin-producing cells. Or even if they do, maybe they won't do it as well. So again, we really need to get the answers to these questions before we jump to any conclusions.
Right now they're being called embryonic-like.
Exactly, which means that they can turn into many of the cell types in the body, but again, they may not do it as well, or they may not do as many tricks as stem cells from a normal embryo.
Dr. Robert Lanza, Chief Science Officer of Advanced Cell Technology here in Massachusetts. Dr. Lanza, thank you so much for talking to us about today's news.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And this quick heads up on a story we're going to be following later in the week. What happened to the Marlboro Marine? He was in that iconic war photo from Iraq. We'll also find out what happened to the photographer who took that picture. You're listening to Here and Now. It's that time of year, especially here in New England, thoughts turn to the country's early history, the Mayflower, the Pilgrims, and that first footfall on a rock in Plymouth, Massachusetts that started it all. Except maybe they didn't step on that rock when they sailed from England in 1620, and geez, have you seen the thing lately? It's looking kind of sad. Which is why this month the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation announced plans to repair the covering that shelters Plymouth Rock. Although there's not much that can be done about that crack where someone dropped it. Nathaniel Philbrick is author of the bestseller Mayflower. Nat, I know you have some strong thoughts about Plymouth Rock. It's been broken. It's smaller than people think, but what does it mean to you?
Well, you know, I love Plymouth Rock. It's a rock that's been through a lot, but it's also something that's there. It's not Mount Rushmore, and I think it's almost endearing that it is so much smaller than everyone anticipates it to be.
Well, as a matter of fact, souvenir hunters have chipped away at it. Apparently a large chunk of it served as a doorstep for a Plymouth resident at one point. It was split in half. Remind us of how it was split in half.
Yeah, it was the American Revolution was approaching, and the Sons of Liberty, those patriots, decided they needed a symbol for their cause. They needed the rock. And so they seized upon it literally. They took a cart down to the waterfront and dug it up, extracted it like a bad tooth. Unfortunately, they dropped it and broke it in half. And so leaving the presumably loyalist half in the mud, they took their half into downtown Plymouth, where they set it up beside a Liberty pole, where it was an inspiration to all. And it was at that point, during the second half of the 18th century, that hammer-wielding souvenir hunters began to descend upon the rock, chipping away at it.
Well, now it's in this little area, this protected area in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and people come from around the world. I know you've been to the rock. What's it like when they come and they approach this area where there's this cordoned off, smaller than a lot of people think, rock? How do you see people react to it?
Well, it's funny. It's one of those things. The granite edifice is quite imposing, you know, so it sort of gives you a sense of drama. Okay, so you go up the steps, you make your way to that wrought iron fence, and you look down, and you experience what has been rightly called, I think, the biggest letdown in American tourism. You see this. It's like a pebble with a cement seam down it. It says 1620 on it, and there's cigarette butts and beer cans and all that kind of stuff. And you know, so it's not the hollowed ground of America that you might think.
And it may not even be the rock, because we understand all of this is based on the words of a single man, Thomas Fonts,
right,
whose father told him about the Pilgrims setting foot on the rock. But you say his father may not even have been in Plymouth when the Pilgrims arrived.
No. He came over. It's documented. He came over 3 years later. So he got it secondhand. And it's just interesting. It's not mentioned by William Bradford or Edward Winslow or any of these other Pilgrims who were actually there and wrote a lot about this. And, it was Fonts 100 years later. He said, you know, that he heard a pier was about to be built over this undistinguished boulder. And he said, take me down to the waterfront. And he pointed at it. And as the story goes, tears streaming down his leathery cheeks, he said, my father said the first settlers stepped on that rock, and thus was born the legend of Plymouth Rock.
And yet, in a recent New York Times opinion piece, you compared the rock to Bob Dylan with love for both. What is your love of both?
Well, you know, they are American icons that have been through a lot, that have been sliced and diced and, you know, may have the most intangible connection to a past that they purport to have, but in the end, they're there. And, you know, that's why I love this rock. The more grungier it is, the better. I mean, this is America. And, you know, and in the end, the rock is there, telling us that something important happened in 1620.
That's Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. Nat, thanks as always for speaking to us.
Oh, great. It's been fun. To be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone.
Well, still to come, the Pilgrims used wild herbs at their first Thanksgiving, or at least we think that one is true. We're going to show you how you can do the same after a break, here and now.
All right, Miss Lonely, but you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise.
Longtime listeners may remember Will Gilson. When we first met Will back in 2000, he was a teenager selling herbs from his father's farm at a farmer's market here in Boston. He became something of a child prodigy in the kitchen, and his family opened up their barn to serve Will's herb-infused meals on the weekends. They called it the Herb Lyceum at Gilson's farm in Groton, Mass.
Your first course this evening is a wild mushroom and gorgonzola tart. Now, the way this is done is I take one layer of pastry dough and then top it with a mixture of roasted portobello and shiitake mushrooms.
Well, Will then went on to study at Johnson & Wales and open a restaurant of his own. It's called Garden at the Cellar in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We asked Will to go back to the family farm to prepare some herb-infused Thanksgiving dishes with Here and Now's Rachel Gottbaum.
The herbs we're going to use today predominantly are going to be sage, parsley, and we can even incorporate a little bit of thyme into the stuffing we're going to do today.
All right, well, let's get going. What are we going to start?
I think we'll start with the squash. I'd like to get that roasting first. So okay. The squash salad, in this case, we use buttercup squash, but butternut or my favorite kabocha squash could be used.
So basically, we've got this humongous squash, and what are you going to do to it now?
We're just going to take what I would call top and tail it. You take the top stem off and the bottom stem off, and then you cut it in half, and you slice it into these eighth to quarter inch thick pieces. And then what we'll do with those is grab a baking tray.
You laid these squash pieces out, and you're on the olive oil on the pan. You're salting now.
Yep, just a little bit of kosher salt on top.
And what's your oven going to be at?
Oven's going to be at 350. I'd say these are probably going to be in there about 10 minutes. As soon as that comes out of the oven, you can portion it, plate it, and everything's ready to go.
Okay, so what are we going to do while waiting for the squash?
So in the meantime, turn on some water right here to do some blanching for Brussels sprouts.
How are we going to do these Brussels sprouts?
Brussels sprouts, once we've put them in the pot and blanched them, we're going to slice them in half, put them in a saute pan, a little bit of bacon, a little bit of parsley, and then finish it off with some balsamic vinegar that'll kind of bring all those flavors together.
Are we ready to do that now?
Yep.
Okay, so we've sliced our Brussels sprouts, and they're essentially pretty much cooked. You blanched them for 15 minutes.
No, for only about 2 minutes.
As I was saying.
So we're just going to run over here. We're going to grab a little bit of bacon. So now the bacon is really starting to render out all of its fat, coat the bottom of the pan.
So you're putting these Brussels sprouts sort of flat on the pan here.
Yeah.
Sort of squishing it in with the bacon.
Yeah, and you kind of want to wiggle each one in the bottom of the pan so that the bacon comes around the sides of them and you get the really flat Brussels sprouts right down in the pan. That way they get the nice caramelization. So while this is going, I'm going to grab a little bit of balsamic vinegar and then we're going to deglaze the pan with the balsamic vinegar. So all those really good bits from the bacon and the Brussels sprout that stick in the pan, we're going to add the balsamic vinegar and just let that deglaze the pan and bring all those great flavors back up into one sauce.
So how much balsamic are you adding?
All in all for this dish, for one pan, probably about a tablespoon worth of balsamic vinegar. Woo! I'm just going to shake that pan, and that's going to let all of the flavor really shine through.
Beautiful. Okay, so we're back at our squash salad. We've roasted the squash.
Roasted the squash.
How long do we roast it in a normal oven?
About 10 minutes. To finish off the squash salad, we want to make a little bit of brown butter with sage.
Okay. Wow.
Now the butter's just about brown all the way. You can see little brown sort of specks floating inside the butter. Now we add in the sage leaves, and the sage leaves are almost going to fry.
And they're whole sage leaves.
Whole sage leaves. Put them right in there.
Put in about eight sage leaves in there. And you turned off the heat.
Yep, turned off the heat, and like I said, just letting them fry in here. We don't want that butter to burn.
Okay, so the secret here is turn off the heat once you put the sage leaves in.
Yep.
Okay. So you turn them over.
Yep, turn them over. Make sure they get nice and crispy all the way through. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the sage leaves on some paper towels just so that they drain and they don't get soggy. So I'm just going to make not even really a salad dressing, but just sort of a mixture of lemon juice and olive oil right now to go with this.
Okay, so we've got these slices of squash that you've roasted. You have this buffalo mozzarella. You've got your fried sage. You've drizzled your brown butter and your arugula, which you've just mixed lightly in your lemon olive oil dressing, and you're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I mean, mortals can do this.
This is a very easy salad to do. It's, I mean, I can make everything look really more complicated by how I plate it, but this is a fantastically simple salad. I'm just going to get another sauté pan going because we're going to do some onions and some sausage. I'm going to make a cranberry sausage stuffing. So we're just going to put the onions right in the pan. Make sure that we get them incorporated with that butter. And this is going to cook for about 2 to 3 minutes. Let those onions cook down.
Okay.
And while we're doing that, we're going to take this sausage that we have. So I've added in probably about the equivalent of one medium-sized Italian sausage into this dish. We're going to pick a little bit of thyme.
Okay.
Now we're going to add this thyme into the pan with the onions and the sausage. Flip that all around a little bit more. And that sausage is about 50% of the way cooked, halfway there. So
yum.
Now we're going to add in some cranberries.
Woo!
I've just got a handful of fresh Cape Cod cranberries. And we're just going to put them in there, and then these things are just going to cook down and let their flavor just sort of explode. You know, let that natural juice that's inside them coat the onions and the sausage. And now we're really going to lower the heat.
Okay, that looks really beautiful. Beautiful colors.
So now we're just going to take the mixture that we've sautéed, the onions, the sausage, the cranberries, and the thyme. We're going to put that over the bread. The bread that I toasted off here was from a grocery store's bag of about 6 sandwich rolls. This is probably in this bowl right here, 3 of them. And those 3 are going to be enough stuffing for probably about 4 to 6 people.
Okay. So what are you doing now?
So now we're probably going to put in about, say, start with a half cup of stock.
And it's warm.
And it's warm stock, yeah. And we're going to mix all this together. Let all those flavors really start to become incorporated. Now we're going to cover this with plastic wrap, and it's going to steam in there.
So basically, you've wet your stuffing. It's not soaking, and you're going to now put plastic wrap on it.
Yeah.
So you're not cooking it.
Nope. Really just letting it soak up all of its flavors. The bread's already toasted. The onions and the sausage and the cranberries have all been cooked together. And then you just add in warm broth and let it work its magic.
Wow.
Finish it off with a little bit of fresh thyme.
That's a new one. Okay, so let's see what we've done today. What do we have?
We've got a roasted squash salad. The squash salad, in this case, we use buttercup squash, but butternut or my favorite kabocha squash could be used. We've then roasted that in the oven, topped it off with a little bit of olive oil, buffalo mozzarella, sage leaves cooked in brown butter, and a little bit of arugula salad. We've got a little bit of Brussels sprouts, blanched first, then they've been seared in a pan with a little bit of bacon, deglazed with balsamic vinegar, and finished off with some fresh parsley. Our stuffing that we did, just a little bit of dry bread, toasted in the oven. Then we've taken that out and tossed that with sautéed onions, a little bit of Italian sausage, fresh cranberries, and thyme. Added some vegetable stock into it, and then let that sit, and it just makes a really nice, hearty stuffing.
Well, that is delicious. Thank you so much. I'm going to get home and start making some of these delicious things for Thanksgiving.
Great. Thank you so much for coming out.
Chef Will Gilson speaking with Here and Now's Rachel Gottbaum in the kitchen at the Herb Lyceum at Gilson's Farm in Groton, Massachusetts. For more on the recipes Will was preparing and to watch a video of him doing it, go to our website, here-now.org. Hungry. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.